networks were also hit. So Goyle launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyle Butter Chicken, from the start, was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry, have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Goyle found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Recent studies suggest that Canada Revenue Agency has been singling out Muslim charities for review. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Faisal Kati, writer. This article is published under the heading Islamophobia: Why is Canada unfairly targeting Muslim charities? Stay tuned for more. Islamophobia and targeting of Muslims in Canada have been in the news in the recent weeks, but this has been a daily reality for far too many Muslims for far too long. Whether in the guise of national security surveillance, deviations from normal due process, no-fly list inclusion, anti-niqab legislation, and even the targeting of Muslim institutions. From the outpouring of support in the wake of the recent attack in London, Ontario, it would appear that the silent majority of Canadians have only love for all, but they have been fed a lot of misinformation and fear over the years, and we are now seeing the consequences. Certain Canadian politicians and segments of the media shoulder much of the blame for the portrayal of Muslim men as potentially dangerous criminals and Muslim women as imperiled and in need of rescue. This bigotry is rooted in a culture of fear that has been nurtured for decades by many people in positions of power. The Canadian government has played a major role in breeding Islamophobia, and two reports issued this year confirm some of the community's worst fears when it comes to targeting Muslim charities. Some of Canada's 1.5 million Muslims are worried about being unjustly flagged for giving to Muslim charities. Several charities have had to shut down as some institutions have attracted excessive scrutiny. Last month, the National Civil Liberties Coalition, representing dozens of groups, accused the Canada Revenue Agency, CRA, of singling out Muslim charities. Its report reveals how, as Canada ramped up attempts to counter terrorist financing after 9/11, the CRA and its charities directorate were enlisted to monitor the work of Muslim charities in Canada under the premise that they pose the greatest terror financing risk. This work has been carried out largely by the Review and Analysis Division, RAD, a secretive arm of the CRA that works with national security agencies. This has led to an unfair and disproportionate targeting of Muslim charities with little accountability and no independent review, the report notes. Among its findings, the report shows that the Canadian government's risk assessment for terrorism financing in the charitable sector focuses almost exclusively on Muslim charities, with little to no public substantiation of the risk that is used to justify the surveillance, monitoring, and audits of Muslim charities on questionable grounds, and that these policies have resulted in revocation of charitable status for Muslim charities, harming the sector and impacting the larger Muslim community. According to the report, between 2008 and 2015, a full 75% of all charities who had their status revoked after RAD audits were Muslim groups. Since then, another four Muslim charities have had their status pulled. The report further notes that none of the groups nor individuals associated with them have been charged with any terrorism-related offenses. The CRA's response is that it does not audit based on any particular faith or denomination. But this position is hard to accept, given that the report is not the first to allege such discrimination. A joint report issued in March by the University of Toronto and the National Council of Canadian Muslims states similar concerns, concluding that audits of Muslim charities have not been random and identifying policies and patterns demonstrating potential biases. The report suggests that the Canadian government's approach to anti-terrorism financing and anti-extremism makes Muslim-led charities exceptionally vulnerable to disproportionate scrutiny audits and, or worse, revocation of charitable status. It cites a structural bias that casts Muslims and their lifestyles and activities as inherently foreign, thus rendering the idea of a domestic Canadian Muslim questionable. Disturbingly, the study points to a policy under which the government can suspect Muslim-led charities of being vulnerable to terrorist financing without any concrete evidence. It also cites a prejudicial policy that looks for, anticipates, and prevents radicalization and extremist violence before it happens, disproportionately impacting Muslim groups suspected of holding conservative views. As highlighted by these reports, such audits offer possible administrative cover for structural biases in Canada's anti-terrorism financing and anti-radicalization policies shaping the gathering, analysis and interpretation of evidence in audits of Muslim charities. These findings should bother any fair-minded Canadian due to the negative impact on charter-protected religious and equality rights. But if that's not enough, consider that this kind of discriminatory treatment can only further marginalize and alienate some of the country's 1.5 million strong Muslim population. Rooted in Islamophobia, such ill-conceived and misguided attempts to thwart radicalization may do the opposite, giving extremists fodder to exploit by confirming a war on Islam. targeting Muslim charities will not stop Muslims from giving to fulfill their religious duty. It will only erode trust in both government systems and the Muslim charitable sector. The two reports reveal the need for a formal commitment from the Canadian government to investigate patterns of bias within its agencies and bureaucracies. To this end, a coalition of more than 130 groups have written an open letter calling on the Trudeau government to refer the RAB auditing processes to the newly constituted National Security and Intelligence Review Agency to ensure that groups are not being targeted due to racial or religious prejudice. In the interim, the signatories are demanding a moratorium on these targeted audits of Muslim charities. The letter also calls on the government to revisit how its anti-terrorism policies are impacting Muslims and urges greater oversight of the CRA when it comes to such audits, which is undermining the Canadian values of due process and fairness. As Ottawa prepares for a national action summit on Islamophobia in the wake of the recent London killings, it is part time for the government to take concrete action against systematic and structural Islamophobia within its own agencies.
We get people. Crushing voice of dissent.
The US government recently took down dozens of Iranian and regional websites, including the .com domain of global broadcaster Press TV. The move was made with no advance warning or explanation, with Washington not even immediately acknowledging that the so-called seizure had been engineered by them.
Increasingly, with the growth of alternative media and the wide attention it receives through the internet, social media, and similar means, this is being challenged in a way that we haven't really seen before.
It can't allow for alternative opinions to be out there, and it will strong arm and do whatever it takes to silence anyone who challenges their hegemony.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host Mila Jabamadi, and in this episode, we take a look at the latest illegal move by the US government, this time by targeting media outlets, challenging US hegemony both inside the United States as well as thousands of miles away in West Asia. Stay with us.
What the U.S. did to Iranian websites was a breach of all principles of freedom of speech, which the United States is proud of. They restricted freedom of speech. We condemn this measure. We will use all our legal and international means to counter this wrong policy of the United States. It is not a constructive move at a time when nuclear talks are underway in Vienna.
Today, the domain has been seized, but the contents sitting on the servers have been untouched. Instead of pointing to the right place on the internet, the .com now points to an FBI warning instead. Yet Press TV's .ir domain works fine.
Viewers and readers of Press TV are mostly aware that the outlet frequently reports news purposely unreported by mainstream media. There's also the underreported, and these stories usually involve the rights of suppressed people, namely in Palestine and Yemen. We're now joined by investigative journalist based in Mexico City, Alex Rubenstein. Alex, thank you for joining the show.
Hi, Milad. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Alex, what do you think the seizure of the PressTV.com domain says about the U.S. crackdown on alternative media?
Well, I think it shows that the United States has total disregard for the principles that it was founded on, namely free speech and freedom of the press. You know, it's clear that, you know, I talked to another host on Press TV recently about the U.S. seizure of $100 million worth of Iranian crude oil. And what that shows is that the United States wants to have global control over the world economy and trade. But in order to do that, they need to have global control over, you know, journalism, in order to make sure that their narratives are not challenged, which Press TV was doing.
More than anything else, the seizure was similar to a hacking operation by black hat hackers, rather than the official confiscation of a media outlet deemed illegal by the U.S. government. The .com domain of Press TV was blocked along with more than 30 other Iranian and regional websites that the U.S. government would rather not exist.
The superpower fundamentally exists on the idea of keeping the water murky and other nations in the dark. Reports critical of U.S. policies and measures are barely tolerated, and the government spares no efforts in promoting its one-sided sequence of events in favor of Washington and the Zionist lobby. Our next guest is Joe Catron, activist and commentator, as well as the U.S. coordinator for Samidon Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. As you know, Press TV has been accused of spreading disinformation. Where does Washington really stand on disinformation, and how much do they use the issue as an excuse to silence media outlets projecting the voice of dissent?
Well, Washington, D.C. is strongly in favor of disinformation and one of its most enthusiastic purveyors. On a single issue, which I follow closely, Palestine, the sheer amount of disinformation that comes out of the State Department and is typically, with some exceptions, repeated verbatim by our mainstream media is astounding. I mean, to cite one recurring example, how many times have we seen references to Israel retaliating against actions by the Palestinian resistance? There may have been a case once when some mainstream outlet reported on the resistance retaliating against Israeli aggression, which is almost always the case. But if so, I missed it. It's certainly not the normal pattern.
Very well. Many thanks for your insight, Joe Catron, activist and commentator. Stay with us for more.
The U.S. crackdown on alternative media is no surprise. The U.S. has been suppressing the voice of dissent for a long time, and the seizure of Press TV's website certainly fits into that picture. The latest round of censorship was directly aimed at not just Press TV, but the resistance movement against U.S. hegemony in the entire region. The bellicose measure was made as Tehran and Washington were engaged in indirect talks, trying to revive the 2015 nuclear accord, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
Well, I think this is the latest salvo in the information warfare that's been happening kind of around the world as states are seeing new ways to exert their foreign policy priorities through internet governance. And what we're seeing is with the seizure of the domain name system, you know, these websites, that the U.S. is trying to convey its power and its foreign policy priorities.
The United States' hunger for dominance on the social media and television is endless. The bellicose measure was made in part to ascertain that media coverage of the negotiations were politically in favor of the Biden administration, a Democratic administration that tries to portray the United States as a proponent of liberty and free speech.
Since its nascent day, Press TV has been speaking truth to power by exposing corruption and double policies in Washington. It's no surprise that the latest act of aggression by the American government also has something to do with that.
As always, the Americans are pressing their negotiating parties to change course in favor of Washington's interests, something that Tehran has vehemently refused to accept. The seizure of PressTV.com seems like an attempt to make sure Iran's interests and U.S. dirty politics are not represented online.
As I said, the U.S. government sees the hegemony which it's exercised up until now over information and its distribution as a key asset in its overall aggression against many people around the world. Obviously, it doesn't want alternative sources of information spreading truth, which it would just as soon cover up. This is something that it sees as undercutting not only its media narrative, but also its broader material interests and its ability to dominate the world.
The United States is an old empire trying to have control over everything, including the political narrative cherry-picked and manipulated to its favor. Washington has long claimed to be a proponent of diverse voices, a claim that sits awkwardly alongside its brazen attempts to gag independent media outlets.
We cannot live in a vibrant democracy unless people get divergent sources of information and have the opportunity to hear a serious debate about the major issues facing our country. And when you have a smaller and smaller number of large media conglomerates owning and controlling what the American people see, hear, and read, you have a real threat to the kind of democracy that many of us want this country to be.
When it comes to media outlets critical of the system by reporting the truth, there seems to be no tolerance in Washington as it desperately moves to somehow crush the opposing ideas. Both the IRIB and the Iranian Foreign Ministry have condemned the move, vowing to come out with a stronger resolve in addressing the power play in America.
The people controlling our media have been fairly successful until now, not only because of their stranglehold on our traditional channels of information, what we call the blue chip media, the major television networks, newspapers, etc., but also the steps they've taken to discourage and prevent access to alternative sources like Press TV and other Iranian and regional media, as well as outlets elsewhere in the world against which we've seen similar measures, if not quite comparable to these new ones.
The U.S. has accused the websites of spreading disinformation, while in reality the monopoly it holds on media involves tampering with the truth. Media outlets controlled by the United States work based on profit.
When you look at who's on the boards of media corporations, they're also on the boards of U.S. oil companies, and they're on the boards of U.S. military contractors. So trying to study who owns America, you're really also, these are the people that own the media. We don't have a state media, but in some ways it's very much like a state media. It's the corporate state.
On the other hand, U.S. media outlets have never been as consolidated, so they tend to give their consumers what they want to hear and act in their interests of the umbrella corporations controlling them. The victims are Press TV and other anti-U.S. outlets, such as Al Masira TV and Al Alam TV.
Well, the maintenance of this stranglehold on information, which the U.S. government and its loyal media and ultimately the ruling class which controls both, is to ultimately maintain the United States ruling class's interests in the world, their control over its people and resources, which many are fighting to resist in numerous regions, not just the Middle East, but in Latin America, across Africa, we see resistance spreading. And the U.S. government is fairly desperate to discourage people from considering what this means for them.
After all, the .com and .net addresses are generic domains not specific to any particular country. On the other hand, U.S.-owned social media such as Twitter and Facebook are amplifying disinformation and cracking down on freedom of speech.
The Islamic Republic is using all international and legal means to act accordingly in response to the provocative act of sabotage against independent media. But how much trust does US-controlled media really have among people in the United States? And what are the repercussions of not having access to the full truth for the people?
Yeah, well, just recently there was a poll of 46 countries that ranked trust in their domestic media. And of those 46 countries, the United States came last in terms of trust, with only 29% of people trusting the media. And, you know, this is deserved. You know, as much as myself as a journalist would like it if people trusted people like me.
Great. Stay with us. We have more.
The U.S. and its allies in West Asia region are determined to maintain their media hegemony in the region in order to influence politics there. By joining forces with Israel and Saudi Arabia, the United States seeks to repress freedom of expression and control people's minds. U.S. support for its allies in information warfare is identical to its military support for real wars. The U.S. operation of the media is the same. Both inside the country and outside, people are the target of disinformation campaigns. The power-hungry politicians certainly don't want to highlight the atrocities carried out by their friends and allies.
I think that this seizure comes at a striking moment, considering the state of the current negotiations in Vienna. I think it's very clear to all of us, either that Joe Biden has no interest in returning to the nuclear agreement in any meaningful way, or that someone else in his administration is determined to stop him from doing so. Which of those is the case, I'm not sure. But one of them is clearly true. Beyond that, I think that the United States' aggressive actions against Iranian and regional media indicate its fear of different narratives and true facts.
The pace of media takeovers by large national and multinational corporations has been increasing since the mid-20th century. Currently, six giant conglomerates control 90% of what media consumers read, watch, and listen to. General Electric, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, News Corp, and Disney control a majority of American-owned media.
Together, these six empires, federations, alliances own about 90% of all media in the United States. In 1983, or the old Republic era, there were 50 companies owning that same share of media. So why is this important? Should you be worried? Well, it's not exactly a black and white issue.
Enormous media conglomerates have expanded their influence, leading to a shortage of meaningful content and alternative points of view. Trust in the mainstream news media is being steadily eroded.
The mainstream press in the United States lied the American public into the Iraq War. They lied about every single major conflict that the United States has engaged in, basically forever. You know, Julian Assange, the great journalist Julian Assange, he has a quote where he says something along the lines of, if wars can be started by lies, then peace can be started by truth. But there's very little truth in the mainstream media, and that's reflected in this poll. And, you know, what it leads to is we have a situation in the United States where there's, like, all-out culture war. You know, people are very divided along partisan lines, and it's not going to get better. It's going to mean more violence in the streets, more distrust of authorities and the media, which, to me, is earned by them. But it's going to be an ugly situation, and it's only going to get worse.
The stereotype of an American surfing through television channels somehow captures the struggle for finding out the truth. But those high up want to stay in power, prepared to do whatever it takes to manipulate the discourse. It's not the first time that the United States has seized domain names of sites which actively expose the real intentions of the U.S. government and its moral bankruptcy.
joined for this episode of We the People by Ben Norton. He is the assistant editor of The Gray Zone and the producer and co-host of the Moderate Rebels podcast. Ben, thanks so much for joining us. The seizure of Press TV's website by the FBI and the U.S. Department of Justice on June 22nd sent shockwaves throughout the alternative media sphere, but this seems like the kind of development that could have major ramifications not only for outlets dedicated to challenging corporate media narratives, but also for just about everybody. So, Ben, what can you tell us about what the U.S. government takeover of Press TV's page might mean for the average American viewer?
This is a pretty frightening development, and it's extremely hypocritical, given the U.S. government justifies its foreign intervention in the internal affairs of many countries by claiming that those governments supposedly are violating press freedoms. We see a campaign right now against the elected government in Nicaragua claiming falsely that the Sandinista government violates press freedoms. We've, of course, seen so much propaganda against Russia, China, and many other countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is not only violating press freedom, it is actually stealing the property of foreign media outlets. And we're talking about dozens of foreign media outlets. Ironically, some of those foreign media outlets were, in fact, anti-Iran outlets. They were opposition outlets that pushed a U.S. government line. But that's, you know, the U.S. government at work. It doesn't really care if you're Iranian, if you're Yemeni, if you're from a country that the U.S. is targeting for regime change. They don't really distinguish civilians from the government. It's all just a war on the collective civilian population. And I have to say, as an independent journalist, as someone who helps to run an independent news website in the United States, it's very frightening for us, because the U.S. government has essentially said to everyone in the entire world that the U.S. government controls all domain names that end in .com, .net, .org, and a variety of other names. So if the U.S. government doesn't like what we, as U.S. citizens, as journalists, independent journalists, are publishing about its crimes abroad, about its wars and regime change operations, then the U.S. government has effectively sent a warning out, a threat to journalists around the world, saying that it reserves itself the so-called right to seize their journalism, to seize their property, because the U.S. says that supposedly it violates national security or whatever term they use to justify it. I mean, this is an egregious form of censorship targeting not only Iranian media and Yemeni media, but really media around the world, every single website that ends in .com, which happens to be a majority of websites on the internet.
Well, Ben, obviously there's a significant impact here, especially for people fighting back against and resisting these dominant government narratives coming out of the United States, coming out of the European Union, coming out of the global north more broadly. But what can you tell us about what all of this means for just the regular, everyday viewer in the United States? You know, the people who have as their only alternative to Press TV these same corporate media outlets that are out there currently.
The United States media is controlled almost entirely by five corporations, which dominate over 90% of the media, the news media in the United States. And all of those mainstream corporate outlets just echo the U.S. government line. We've seen it again and again, whether it's the so-called weapons of mass destruction they use to justify the illegal war in Iraq, or the claim by this young girl who ended up being the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador that Iraqi soldiers were taking babies out of incubators, or that Muammar Gaddafi in Libya was supposedly giving Viagra to his soldiers to rape women. All of those were blatant lies created by the U.S. government and then just spoon-fed to the media, which just did it, just spread the lie willingly without any, you know, need to be pressured. I mean, the media in the U.S. is one of the most servile, propagandistic medias in the entire world, and the options for Americans to get access to alternative information shrinks every year. The U.S. government is trying to control everything. It's part of its strategy of so-called full-spectrum dominance. So the U.S. is waging war around the world, imposing sanctions on a quarter or a third of the global population. And at home, the U.S. government is trying to block all independent media outlets to have total control of people's lives. I mean, it really is the definition of authoritarianism.
Absolutely. Well, we want to thank you so much, Ben, for breaking all of that down for us. We want to thank the viewers at home as well for tuning in. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
dot-com seizure has failed to weaken the morale of Press TV's website staff, and they keep working hard to make sure connections to their readers remain as strong as before. After all, those reading Press TV are fed up with lies superpowers want to feed them and seek truth despite all the noise on TV and social media. That was our show. Please join us again next week on another episode of We the People.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The news from the South American country of Chile that an indigenous woman has been elected to a new assembly charged with drafting the national constitution is a step in the right direction after centuries of oppression of the Mapuche people by the ruling elite of Spanish ancestry. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Cajon International. This article is published under the heading, The Awakening of the Chilean People. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The news from the South American country of Chile that an indigenous woman has been elected to a new assembly charged with the drafting of the national constitution is a step in the right direction after centuries of oppression of the Mapuche people by the ruling elite of Spanish ancestry. Elisa Lancon, a 58-year-old Santiago University professor and activist of the Amerindian movement for the Mapuche people's educational and linguistic rights, will draft a new text to replace Chile's current constitution, which is a product of 17-year reign of terror of General Augusto Pinochet, a CIA agent who overthrew the elected government of Salvador Allende in 1973. As a matter of fact, memories of Pinochet continue to haunt most Chilean people who remember tens of thousands of citizens disappeared and decimated on U.S. orders. Even after his exit from the political scene, Pinochet, who was protected by the American and Zionist spy agencies continue to indirectly wield power over the hapless people of Chile through proxies serving as chief executives. The current head of state, President Sebastián Piñera, is also viewed by the Chilean people as a U.S. stooge, and it remains to be seen whether he would allow Elisa Lankan to draft a fair and all-representative constitution acceptable to the majority of citizens. According to the latest figures, Amerindians make up almost 40% of the Chilean population, while power rests in the hands of the white people of Spanish stock, who reportedly account for 55% of all citizens. Mapuche people had bravely resisted the invasion of their land in the 16th century by the Spanish and even inflicted several defeats on the European invaders until firepower subdued the lightly armed defenders who had only bows and arrows. Chile gained independence from direct rule from Spain in 1817 because of the liberation campaign launched in southern parts of South America by the Argentinian commander, José dos San Martín. Unfortunately, Chile soon found itself trapped in U.S. hegemony, which is the main reason for the current widespread political and economic corruption. The Chilean people resent U.S. domination as well as the intrusion of the Israelis to plunder their country. It is worth recalling that a couple of years ago, in the wake of victories in the West for the movement known as BDS or Boycott, Divest, Sanctions Movement against the Israeli regime, Valdivia in southern Chile became the first city in all of Latin America to officially join the boycott against the Zionist regime for its apartheid policies, military occupation of the West Bank, and illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip. The measure adopted by Valdivia specifically declares the municipality as an apartheid-free zone and prohibits the city from working with any business that is linked to the Zionist entity. The local BDS campaign that helped prompt Valdivia's government to adopt the boycott was led by the Juventud Chileno Arabi por Palestina do Valdivia, JCAPV, which is comprised mostly of university students attending Austral University of Chile. Several politicians, including some members of the Chilean Senate, were also involved in the campaign. In view of these developments, it is hoped that the indigenous people, as well as the conscious white people of European ancestry, will facilitate the work of Elisa Lankan to draft a fair constitution acceptable to the majority of the Chilean people.
Midstream.
Lebanon's economic and financial crisis could rank as one of the three most severe the world has seen since the mid-19th century. The public are accusing Lebanon's authorities of deliberately failing to mount an adequate policy policy response to the country's worsening economic and financial crisis. Lebanon's descent into what could end up being one of the top three worst crises in 150 years has been stunningly swift. The country's gross domestic product GDP, which measures the total output of goods and services, nosedived from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year, as per the latest Lebanon Economic Monitor released by the World Bank last week. The inaction by Lebanese authorities is not due to lack of knowledge or quality advice, but rather the failure to agree on effective policy initiatives and a political consensus that defends a bankrupt economic system, which, by the way, benefited a few for so long. The crisis has caused a grave social fallout that has pushed more than half of the population below the poverty line. The decimated purchasing power of the Lebanese pound has led to more than 40% of households reporting challenges in accessing food and other basic needs. Meanwhile, the nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the same year. Such dire socioeconomic conditions risk systematic national fallings with regional and potentially global consequences. Propelled by popular desperation and anger, impulsive protests now mark the advent of a longer period of unrest, chaos, and even a social explosion across the country as conditions continue to deteriorate. Lebanon is suffering from poor governance and a gaping lack of public accountability. To date, the country's three overlapping crises, a financial meltdown, the catastrophic Beirut port explosion, and the COVID-19 pandemic, have not been met with an effective government response. On the contrary, years of government corruption and incompetence laid the ground for Lebanon's accelerating collapse. Many observers have become habituated to Lebanon's dysfunction and perpetual sense of crisis, but Lebanon's current predicament marks a real departure from the past. Even in the worst days of the civil war, while lacking a government, Lebanese found informal ways to keep the country somewhat functioning. This time, it's a different Lebanon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Crisis hit Lebanon over the weekend, teetered on the verge of complete chaos driven by the Lebanese pound's dramatic nosedive against the dollar that sent agitated Lebanese to the streets across the country, blocking highways with burning tires in Beirut and other areas, and attacking public utilities to protest the deteriorating economic conditions. Now, this coincided with the breakdown of public services that has left the country in total darkness, and with closed gas stations as a result of severe fuel, gasoline, and diesel shortages that have threatened to bring a complete halt to private generators on which the majority of the Lebanese public and businesses, including hospitals, depend for electricity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the collapsing Lebanese pound, which sank to a record low for the first time in Lebanon's history, trading at almost 18,000 Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar on the black market, coincided with the breakdown of the public services, as we just said, especially electricity, because there is no fuel to power the generators. No securing basic public services by any authority is like basically saying, we want chaos. Go ahead and bring about the chaos to the country. Who benefits from all of this in Lebanon right now?
Hi to you. Thank you for having me. As we know, everybody knows in Lebanon, and probably, most probably, the Europeans who really were the patronizing of the Lebanese political situation from the 90s with Rafiq Hariri, the martyr of Lebanon. And we know the situation in Lebanon is very miserable. It's going to abyss, and nobody would really have a kind of relief for what's going on. There are some thieves in Lebanon, especially in the political class, with their manager of this partnership between the capitalists, the bank owners, and some of the mafias of the sects in Lebanon, who are leading this country into this abyss. I'm not surprised of this collapse of the Lebanese pound. I'm really anxious about the future of Lebanon after this very critical situation. The situation is not only economic situation, it's a political situation. The Americans and the Europeans, especially the French, now talking about a new mandate for Lebanon because of the political change in the region. Now we have many choices probably. First of all, we have to get rid, to reconstruct Lebanon, to get rid of all these mafias and the bank owners and this system, this capitalist or this new liberal system. Would the Americans agree? Of course not. They are not eager to see solutions in Lebanon. They are not eager to see Lebanese are satisfied with their authorities. There are no actual authorities to authorize good things or to lead the state into a safe place. Actually, I'm really hesitant to say that all these people who are the solution in their hand are the thieves of the money of the country.
But
while billions.
This brings us to that worse still. Lebanon was quickly sliding into political abyss, into risk of instability, into social unrest. The top leaders even failed to agree on forming a cabinet, a new government, to at least rescue what's left in the country's economy. Can you explain to us the dilemma that led to the state of political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, really, really, people, the Lebanese people, they have unveiled all these ambiguities and the Lebanese situation, and now they know that these people who are leading, or what so-called leaders in Lebanon, are not deserving this place or post or position because they have stolen all the money of the Lebanese. And that's why I guess the Lebanese have the right to raise their voice and go into demonstration or saying that we have no confidence, no trust whatsoever in this class. And the problem is that all these people were protected by the Americans and the French. And most of them, they have connections with the American embassy and with the Saudis. Now the Saudis raise their hand and say, well, we don't want Hariri, because they said they really said we have paid a lot of money for some of them. Well, most of them, they counted from Jaja to Hariri and others. Well, not to say about other people, because these people are really leading the situation in Lebanon into this catastrophe. And they, of course, they can't. They can't make or shape or form any new government that would lead to a solution in Lebanon and relieve people.
Well,
because
in the
are the problem. Because
exactly.
They are the, they
in
are
the media,
problem.
It's
how could
being,
a man
being shaped otherwise
yeah.
in
yeah.
the media? How is it being shaped in the internal and also the foreign media? It's being shown that there is a dilemma, there is a problem, a bickering problem between President Aoun and the Premier designate Saad al-Hariri, who, by the way, has been designated since October 22, 2020. Now, they are trading accusations. Each one is just pointing to the other being of blame. And one wants to form a cabinet of non-partisan specialists to enact reforms and salvage the country from an all-out economic collapse, while the other seemingly wants to secure what is called in the media the Christian rights. What's the main reason for this statement?
The main reason.
If Hariri actually has internal and external support, then what does President Aoun want?
Let's say it frankly, for once and for all. President Aoun came to the presidency in order to reform and make some ameliorations to the system, and he could not, because this mafia in these authorities in the state, they have prevented and blocked any kind of reformation, because they have taken the money of the country, they have stolen the money of the country. How could they help General Aoun, President Aoun, in order to reform. That's the problem, I guess, because also with the political reasoning that would say General Aoun really stood by the resistance in Lebanon, and he did not do what the French and the Saudis want to do in Syria. All this, they are punishing these people, the environment, the embracive environment of the resistance in Lebanon. And I guess this is a kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. What would they do in the future in order to solve the situation, because their men are really the problem? Would they agree, the French, and they are putting now some sanctions on their men? Would that solve the situation? I really don't know.
One more minute in this segment, Dr. Saleh, but the pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and the basic items have skyrocketed in prices. Do you think that we are looking at the biggest social and economic catastrophe, actually, in West Asia, or is there still time to salvage something?
Well, we are in turmoil. I guess the Americans want to see this kind of turmoil in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and other places, also in Yemen. They are really putting sanctions in order to these countries, to these states, to collapse.
Seems they are succeeding, though.
I guess the peoples of the West Asian countries, they can rebuild and reconstruct these countries because they are the heritage of the Americans and the French. We have one choice only, to get rid of these peoples of between brackets, the Americans and the French and the Saudis, and mm-hmm. without kicking out these people from the decision maker of in Lebanon and in other places in Iraq or in Yemen, the Hadi and his gangs. I guess without that, we can't rebuild mm-hmm. these countries and the region. And we are really, peoples are trying, resisting all this kind of hegemony from the 20th century till now. Peoples are going in the right track.
Hopefully so. Thank you very much from Beirut, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for being with us to talk about the economic and social collapse in Lebanon. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the Yemeni armed forces announced earlier last week a military operation targeting Saudi forces, where days after the announcement, the Yemeni military media broadcasted scenes from the operation of the Yemeni armed forces targeting this camp of the Saudi coalition with dozens of Qasif 2K drones in the Al-Wadi'a border area. Now, spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Al-Sariya announced the killing of a number of Saudi officers and the killing of more than 60 fighters in the ranks of the Saudi coalition aggression. In this large-scale military operation, more in this following report.
Clashes intensified during the past week between the Yemeni armed forces and forces loyal to the outgoing President Abdel Mansour Hadi within the Rahwan district, the second largest district of Ma'rib governorate, which extends from northwest to west. This came in the wake of Hadi's forces violating a tribal truce signed in earlier March 2020 between Sana'a forces and some of the leaders of the Rahwan tribes, which stipulated the commitment of the army and popular committees not to attack the district's areas that had been neutralized from the ongoing confrontations. Under the agreement signed by the Marwan and the Shadawda tribes, the largest of the Rahwan tribes, which held for more than a year before Hadi forces violated it, Sana'a granted the people of the district the right to protect and manage the